Our speaker today is Dr. Donald Deffner. He is originally from Kansas and was educated here at Concordia Seminary, receiving a BA in 1945 and a BD in 1947. A Master of Arts degree from the University of Michigan in 1946. A PhD from the University of California in Berkeley in 1957. And a THD from Berkeley in 1962. He was ordained in 1947 at the University Lutheran Chapel in Berkeley, California, where he served as the campus pastor until 1959. Then he served as a professor here at Concordia Seminary from 1959 to 1969, and also as chairman of the Department of Practical Theology. He also served as a guest professor at Concordia Seminary in Springfield, Illinois, from 1963 to 1969. And is a professor at Pacific Lutheran Seminary and the Graduate Theological Union at Berkeley from 1969 to 1987. He has been a guest professor of Christian Education and Homiletics at Concordia Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana since 1987. And he has also served as a technical advisor to the Office of Chaplains, serving the Air Force, Army, and Navy installations in Alaska and the Aleutian Islands. He has authored or edited 19 books, 9 of which are still in print, and numerous manuscripts, articles, and magazines. His book, The Compassionate Mind, Theological Dialogue with the Educated, is part of the new Concordia Scholarship Series. He is married and has 4 children. Today he will speak to us on the topic, Who Are You, the Preacher? A groper, a gripper, a grouper, or a griper? We welcome from our sister seminary, Dr. Donald Deffner. Thank you.
Rather than say good morning, I would prefer to say the Lord be with you. My mentors were Arthur Carl Peepcorn, A.R. Kretzmann, P.H.D. Lang, and men like that. On the West Coast, they have the habit these days of starting the service out with good morning. As long as they're going to do that, they might just as well end the service with have a nice day. On being introduced, I'm always reminded of the story of Winston Churchill, who in his later years was a member of a Toastmasters group, and you had to get up and speak on any subject without previous warning. Well, Churchill always won the prize because he knew something about every topic. He was a brilliant man, written many books. But this one time, they thought they had the old boy. The MC gets up and he says, and now we introduce to you the Right Honorable Sir Winston Churchill, who will speak to us on the subject of sex. They thought they had him. But Churchill got up, he says, gentlemen, gives me the greatest pleasure, and he sat down. My own background, I see former students and former colleagues here. It's a joy to be with you. I first came here 48 years ago, and then the 60s are great times to remember. I was brought up in a parsonage, shipped off to prep school, St. John's Winfield, at the age of 13, spent 9 years of my life in dormitories, and wasn't really sure I was going into the ministry. That last year, I was going to do doctoral work at Michigan, but campus ministry was my first love, and I went out there for 12 years in Berkeley in the 50s, and I guess I left just in time because the 60s were coming. And I was here for 10 years and accepted a call out there, always stayed Missouri Synod, accepted the call in 68, so I guess I left here again just in time. And then after about 18 years out there, of course, Berkeley had changed a great deal, and it's a very laid-back theology and a very laid-back culture. I don't know if you've heard the story of the gay fellow that walks into a Greek Orthodox church and he sees the priest standing there with his black cassock and swinging the incense, and he walks up to the priest and he says, I love your dress, dearie, but your purse is on fire. So I left Berkeley about 4 years ago. Again, I think just in time. And I've been enjoying very much teaching fall and spring quarters and home winter and summer and doing continuing ed, doctor of ministry courses around the country. Several purposes in what I'd like to do in these 47 minutes. And that is to challenge you where you're at in dealing with people in our culture. How insulated are we in the way that we preach and teach in dealing with the people in our culture, the real world that people live in. We want to bring them the real word for the real world. To whom are we preaching? Who really are the people that we are teaching? I'd like to highlight the need to be very sensitive to the mass media and their impact upon people. I'd like to make a rich use of illustrations. As Spurgeon said, they're the windows that let in the light. I use that in the richest, broadest sense. Our Lord always told a story. Matthew 13:34 says he never spoke to them, but he always told them a story. This is a straight presentation. It's deductive, albeit I pray with some telling inductive questions. I think deductive method can be just as much of a learning situation as dialogue can be. In preaching, if we are really preaching dialogically, people can have sweat under their arms, but you're sending out a message, they're getting it, they're having the aha experience, and maybe they punch you in the nose at the door, but that's communication. At least it's been heard and acted upon. Marty, when I first heard him speak some years ago over on a street near here, I heard a great deal about this brilliant theologian. I thought, well, I'll go see for myself. And here he was rattling along in this high-pitched voice just as fast as he could. And I was writing down on the backs of envelopes and everything as fast as I could. It was a straight lecture, but I was learning. He was at the growing edge of where I was. He was in tune with our culture. How sensitive are we in our preaching and our teaching to our culture? Are we really relating to it? One of our campus pastors on the West Coast spoke to a agnostic professor who was retiring, and he said, campus pastor said, you've got many relatives who are in the Lutheran Church, don't you? Yeah. I said, well, how come you never became a member of the Lutheran Church? And he said, well, frankly, most of the Lutheran pastors that I know are just dumb, just plain dumb. Now, present company accepted, of course. But that was where he was coming from. Or it's like the old police chief sitting in the front row in a church in Florida. He's seen everything that happened in that town Saturday night through the night. And he's hearing Pastor Schultz up there going on and on. And he says, Pastor Schultz, that's just not where it's at least in terms of the world that he lives in. I'm not putting down our pastors in the field. It's very easy for a prop to do that. But I'm saying, don't we need to constantly check ourselves? Do we really know the sitzim leben of our people? Do we know the world, the culture? What molds them? What makes them what they are? I'm concerned about the brother who isn't really relating that inerrant word to the real world that people are living in. So often, our Lord always started with the known and went to the unknown. He started with a death or a marriage or a funeral, and then he went on. This was something in their world, and he went on to the unknown, the principle to be learned. Sometimes we can start with the unknown and go to the unknown. I pick up some of that in the latest CDQ, an article called The Plague of Generic Preaching, which should be here in a few days. Could you, for example, not just say, oh yeah, I know the name, but could you discuss for a few minutes the philosophy of this particular person intelligently? People who, for good or ill, mold people that you and I are preaching to and trying to teach. Susan Lucci, or Lucci, Queen of the Daytime Soaps. Danielle Steele. I'm not suggesting this stuff for growth and grace, you know, but 130 million copies of her books are in print. It's pap. But what a powerful force this has in molding the values of many of our people. And a contact point, which then becomes a conflict point as we bring the gospel and say, is this what life is really all about? Who are you? Where are you going? What's the meaning and purpose of life? Orrin Hatch. Bill Moyers, Steven Spielberg, Alan Bloom, was the name of the book he wrote, William Sapphire, Paul Simon, Sidney Sheldon, Albert Camus, I think the greatest novelist in the last 50 years, Mary Beth Whitehead, Alan Goodman, columns in 400 newspapers, your people read them, Amy Grant, James Reston, Michael J. Fox, Shelley Long, Jimi Hendrix, Joan Baez, Glenn Close, what was the movie? Leonard Nimoy, Marjorie Holmes, Bruce Springsteen, Phil Donahue, Crystal Gayle. Do we really know the culture that our people are living in? Well, I don't want to watch some of these things in the afternoons. Idiots talking to idiots on the Oprah Winfrey Show and so on. But a lot of our people really soak it up. Where do they get their values? Blues. 20th century blues are getting me down. Who's escaped those weary 20th century blues? Why, if there's a God in the sky, shouldn't he grin? High above this dreary 20th century din and this strange illusion, chaos and confusion, people seem to lose their way. What is there to strive for, love or keep alive for? Say, hey, hey, call it a day. Blues. Nothing to win or lose. I think those words often describe your and my feelings, even though we are Christians. And so we often walk around with our chins on the ground rather than having them thrust up into the air, from whence we look for the return of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Are you living eschatologically? So I think it's very good to pause occasionally and remind ourselves who we are and whose we are and where we're going. Some years ago, Loretta Young had a television program on which she was a woman psychologist going around asking people what they thought of themselves. What was their self-perception? She asked them a very basic, simple question. Who are you? And one woman said, I'm a gal with 6 kids. One man pushed himself back from his desk and said, who am I? I'm a guy being divorced by his wife. She asked it of one woman, and who are you? Says, oh, I'm just a nurse, just a nurse. One man, I'm just a truck driver. One man turned away in fear, thinking she was a private investigator. It's the basic question of life, isn't it? Who are you? The real you. Will the real you please stand up? You, the preacher to be. You, the teacher to be. Years ago, Alvin Robbins, later president of Luther Seminary, had a little catechism on the way, Augsburg 42. And in it, he put it this way. Who are you? Why, don't you remember? Not long ago, when our Father up in the home palace in heaven called you and me aside, and he said, my son, my daughter, out in the sea of space, I have an island. I'm going to send you out there for a while. Now, this won't be a vacation because I have work for you to do. I want you to take some of the peace and love and truth and justice from the home kingdom to that island. Now, when you get there, many of your brothers and sisters, my sons and daughters, who have forgotten all about me and the work I gave them to do, will tell you it doesn't make any difference what you do with your life. But it makes a great deal of difference to me. You see, I love that island. It's a good island. And wherever you are, whether you're a homemaker or a farmer or a businessman, there in that niche in my vineyard, you are to remind others who they are and whose they are and where they're going. You'll miss the home kingdom, long to come back, but that's the work I have for you to do. Now, not all will be happiness on this island, because long ago sin came and brought with it pain and sorrow and death and rebellion, and you cannot escape some of the contagion of that rebellion. But also long ago, I took the great dive, as it were, from heaven down to earth. I became representative man. I focused myself on a human being, Jesus Christ. I let all the hate and evil in the world crush it on him on a cross and kill him. But that wasn't the end, because 3 days later he was raised from the grave. And because he lives, you shall live also. Now one day, I won't tell you when, maybe on a freeway in St. Louis, you come up to a door, and on the door is a simple sign, death. But don't be afraid, because I'll be right on the other side of the door, and I'll take you by the hand, and I'll lead you safely across. Meanwhile, my peace I give unto you. Not as the world giveth, give I unto you. Therefore, let not your hearts be troubled, neither let them be afraid. Well, that's the way Robin has put it in that little poetic vision of reminding ourselves of the transcendence of God and God being above and beyond everything. But we need to remember the other side of God's nature, too, as we recall who we are and don't develop our kind of God, God's kind of God, or as J.B. Phillips said years ago, your God is too small. The imminence of God. Marty tells the story of a rather defensive Christian student on a secular campus who came to an astronomer friend and said, how are you doing in your research into outer space? Oh, we have powerful telescopes, said the astronomer. We can go millions of light years into outer space. Well, is there a point beyond which you can't go, said the Christian defensively. Oh, yes, said the scientist. Oh, that's God, that's God. Months passed by and they met again. The Christian asked, how are you doing in your research into outer space? Oh, we have far more powerful telescopes now. We can go millions of light years further into outer space. Well, is there a point beyond which you can't go? Oh, yes, said the astronomer. Well, that's God. That's God. Well, as Marty notes, God isn't just the holy other, the equation X, the great unknown, but he's the God who is here among us, whose feet were wiped by a woman's hair, who was in all things tempted as we are, fully human, yet without sin. There are always footprints ahead of you, brother and sister, in the valley of the shadow, and they are his. As Catherine Marshall puts it in one of her books, we'd like to take a helicopter and go across the valley, but we have to walk that path. But we are not alone. So that's our job, to understand again and again as we know who we are, God's kind of God. Co-ed walks into a campus pastor's study and says, I'm an atheist. Campus pastor says, well, that's very interesting. Tell me what kind of a God you don't believe in. And for an hour, she tells him. When the hour is over, the campus pastor said, well, you know, that's very interesting. But funny thing is, you know, I must be an atheist too, because I don't believe in that God either. And then he proceeds to tell her about the kind of a God we have, a God who is contemporary, who is discoverable, who does come to us when we but use the means of grace, the power supply by which he comes into our lives. The trouble is, we forget the kind of a God we have and whose we are and where we're going. We join the world in its despair. We let the world around us squeeze us into its own mold, as Phillips renders 12:1 and 2. Don't let the world around you squeeze you into its own mold, but rather let God remold your mind from within, that you may prove in practice that the plan of God for you is good, meets all his demands, and moves towards the goal of true maturity. But we let the world squeeze us into its own mold, we professionals and our people. This is particularly crucial for a pastor. Chrysostom said, can a pastor be saved? And Paul himself, lest after I have preached to others, I myself become a castaway. Along the Norwegian coast, the ships go up and down all the time. It's the lifeline of that little country. And when a ship goes down, people are immediately traumatized. How did it happen? How many lives were lost? And so on. Well, a ship did go down in a certain fjord one night, and people were asking those questions, but the amazing thing was that 10 minutes later, another ship went down in exactly the same place. And the question was asked, how could this happen? And they didn't know until it was determined that this smaller ship that went down second had been following the larger ship without its radar being turned on, thinking that if it just followed the larger ship, nothing could happen to it. Brother, who's following you? Who's the real you in your heart of hearts? As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. Are you Protean? Yale psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, in his book Boundaries, suggests that this is the increasing mood of our day, the advent of the Protean man. Proteus was that character in Greek mythology who could change his shape from boar to lion, to dragon, to fire, to flood. He would not commit himself to a single form or tell his wisdom and prophecy unless changed. Only then he would give an answer and plunge into the sea. Otherwise, he maintained his ever-changing guises, a symbol of our times, suggests Lifton, leading to the identity diffusion and identity confusion of our age. As the sage of history puts it, all things are changing and we are changing with them. So who's the real you as you get up into the pulpit on Sunday morning? And who's the real you in the pews or in the Bible class? Will the real you please stand up? Lifton cites a teacher friend of his who referred to himself as wearing a number of masks, which he could put on or take off, and he wondered which was his authentic mask. And he wasn't sure, and he noted the parallels in literature where there are representations of every kind of crime, every kind of sin, and he added, for me, there's not a single act that I can't imagine myself committing. In the book, Why Do Christians Break Down, by William Mueller, some years ago, Augsburg, he tells the story of when he was a 9-year-old boy, and they were chatting, his mother and old Uncle Ben, who was sort of a balding, big belly type, and Mabel, the lady from next door, very good friend of theirs. They were just having coffee and chatting. Uncle Ben was sort of looking at Mabel from the distance, and all of a sudden, Mabel had one of these dresses with a ring on the top and a zipper all the way down the front. All of a sudden, Ben just walked over to Mabel and put his finger in the ring and unzipped the dress all the way down, and then stood back and admired his handiwork. All of a sudden, he caught himself. He says, "Oh, my goodness, Mabel, I'm sorry. I don't know what came over me. Excuse me, I'm sorry." Just protestation. Mabel said, "It's okay, Ben." And she zipped up her dress again, and the conversation went on. What happened was really that the shadow of Uncle Ben had come out. The real Ben had stood up. Who is your shadow? Who is the real you? Will the real you stand up? Who are you? A groper, a griper, a grouper, or a gripper? I stole these words from Ed Westling, a good friend of mine, with permission, the materialist mind. My philosophy is, if you can find a good idea, steal it. If you go into print, credit your sources. Are you, first of all, a groper? And how am I to face the odds of man's bedevilment and God's eye, a stranger and afraid in a world I never made? That's the philosophy of many of a person today. And we're not just talking about the people in the pew, but how do you and I feel deep in our own hearts at times? I had lunch every day after classes about 1 o'clock or so down by the University of California campus near the Graduate Theological Union, Laval's Pizzeria. The short story is in the book, Compassionate Mind. And, boy, pizza every day for 18 years. Anyway, it's like spaghetti every Sunday night in the campus ministry. But on the men's room wall in one of these, in this restaurant, was the simple graffiti, "Life is the interruption of an otherwise peaceful non-existence." Now, with that particular person, you don't start out with the question, if you were to die tonight, would you go to heaven? That's just not where that person's at, you see. But this is the world of the groper. As one person said, many of the writers of our day, the merchants of despair, are pouring out the philosophy of life that feeds this. They're like people in a ship at sea. They've bashed in the bulkhead, they've opened the petcock, they've knocked down the mast. The ship is sinking. They're wailing that they're lost. Help, help, beetles cry. And they're insisting that everybody else get in the same boat with them. Pastor Ken Hobus, I think it was, in our Dallas apartment ministry some years ago, trying to reach people in these little cubicles. They live in a box, and they put them in a box one day, and then they put them in the ground. So hard to reach these people. And one day in their little service they had, there was just a crumpled note in the offering plate. "God, I hurt. God, I hurt." And yet that's all that some people do, is hurt. All they do is search. All they do is grope. It's one like the one college student says to the other, "What are you doing?" He says, "Oh, I'm searching for God." And the other one says, "Oh, is he lost again?" We've got it just twisted the other way around, of course. A good shepherd is the one who is going out looking for the lost sheep. But many of them remain, like Willie Loman in the classic play, Death of a Salesman. Years ago on the stage, Thomas Mitchell, then in black and white films, Frederick March, and then Dustin Hoffman on TV. Here was Willie Loman, who wanted to be loved, to be accepted, always bragging about himself. "Why, when I die, thousands of people will come to my funeral." And his one character says, "Life's a jungle, Willie. You've got to be hard." And when he's bragging all the time, his one son says, "Dad, you don't have to do that. We like you. We love you." And this one glimmer of hope for Willie in the whole play, he says to his wife, "Did you hear that? Biff, he likes me. He likes me." Oh, he wanted to be accepted. But Willie finally even commits suicide, hoping that his family will collect on the $20,000 life insurance policy. And then comes the funeral. The crowds do not appear. And the wife comes forward and puts some flowers on the grave. And she says, "Willie, why did you do it, Willie? Willie, I paid the last payment on the house today, Willie. Willie, why did you do it?" And then she says, "You know, all he needed was just a little more salary." And the one son says, "Nah, he never knew who he was." What a tragic epitaph. To see a gray slab out in a cemetery out of town here, out of St. Louis. And on the slab is simply the words, "He never knew who he was. She never knew who she was." Because some Christian, tongue-tied, didn't take the time to bring them the good news of Jesus and the resurrection. So many of us, even in our lives as pastors, or as I heard one guy saying this morning, this guy really likes the ministry out there, but he just can't stand people. You know, we can go through the routines and maybe ourselves not even witness when we should. And they never knew who they were. What a contrast. I've got to get a little good news in here. Point is, it's not just them out there that are the gropers. To what extent are we the gropers inside? Well, this woman wasn't a groper. She was in her 90s. She'd had one leg amputated. She used to put the flowers on the chapel altar at our little student chapel in Berkeley. And at the end of her life, I would pray with her. It was like a cathedral of grace, her front room. She prayed by name for students having difficulties. And not long before coming back to her home, I had driven through Nevada, and we stopped for lunch in Las Vegas, just stopping for lunch, of course. And here was a woman playing a slot machine. It was about a 69,000 to one shot to get a jackpot on this dime machine. And her husband wanted to leave. She wanted to stay. He said, okay. She says, hell, you only live once. She pulled the handle, and she got $100. Hell, you only live once. But a week later, I was in this other woman's home. We were praying together. It was like heaven was there already. And she said quietly to me, Pastor Don, isn't it wonderful that this isn't the only life we have? And I thought, what a contrast. Hell, you only live once. And isn't it wonderful this isn't the only life we have? She was no groper. But it's very easy for us to slip into that with the administrivia of the parish and people being what they are. We can lapse into ennui. I won't go into detail here with the pressure of time. It's not a great book. Again, I don't recommend it, but if we read carefully the secular literature of our day, more on that in The Compassionate Mind, I think this is a contact point to reach the thoughtful people, the intellectuals of our day, those who do read great literature. But we can see this pervasive theme of loneliness that comes through again and again, like in Eric Young's Fear of Flying. Was there no way out? Is loneliness universal? This is Paul Morentz, psychiatrist and Lutheran professor. Still the basic problem of man, loneliness. Speaking as a psychiatrist, then he put on his theological hat and said, and it stems from man's original sin, a self-imposed loneliness, an isolation from God back in the Garden of Eden. What kind of questions are people asking? Often it's not an ethical question as much as it is an ontological one. What does it mean to be? What does it mean to exist? Or like my philosophy prof at the University of California said, is the question, is there a meaning and purpose in life, a relevant question? Or do you start with him? So I think this can be a contact point with people, whatever they're reading, to dialogue with. We see this theme of groping coming through again and again. Somebody writes into a Sunday magazine, is Justine author Lawrence Durrell still writing? And he answers, I'm working on another ghastly book, but don't ask me about it. I must either write or commit suicide. At one time, Durrell was a quarter gin a day man, now sticks mostly to wine. He remarks with characteristic drama, I'm worn out with the bore of living. George Sanders was my hero. What a gesture, killing yourself out of sheer boredom. I am dead and longing for embalmment. In Hermann Hesse's Steppenwolf, the central character, Harry Holler, recounts a day that had gone by just as days go by. He recalls it as a day which had not been brightened by happiness and joy. It was bearable and tolerable, the lukewarm days of a discontented middle-aged man. There had been no special pains, cares, worry, or despair, and yet he wondered, objective and fearless, whether it isn't time to follow the example of Adalbert Stifter and have an accident while shaving. Kierkegaard once wrote in his journal, I've just returned from a party of which I was the life and soul. Wit poured from my lips. Everyone laughed and admired me, but I went away and wanted to shoot myself. That's the malaise, the ennui, the boredom, which afflicts so many of our people. Do we identify with it? Do we start there with the known in their life and go to the unknown? Or do we say every time the text for the day, where are they at? And then we bring that word which always exegizes the world, not the other way around, to that painful soul. I don't recommend The Hat on the Bed by John McPartland either. It's not great literature. But I think this can sensitize us to the handwriting on the wall, the prophetic voices in modern fiction, as it were, who tell us not only where our culture is, but where it's going. Here's a successful salesman. He's in your Bible class, or he's in the third row in church. But he couldn't understand why he went through dinner in the entire evening without telling Jean about the T-Bird and two galaxies in one day. He knew it was because he didn't want to give her any good news. That much he understood. She would respond to the good news as she always did, enthusiastically and proudly, and he was in no mood to share her enthusiasm or accept the compliment of her pride in him. All that he understood, but he could not understand why he preferred to remain in this mood. She would cheer him up, and he didn't want to be cheered up. He was perfunctory when the kids kissed him goodnight, and after the 11 o'clock news on the TV, he rose, snapped the power dial, and went to the bedroom. He was in bed when Jean kissed him goodnight and turned out the light. Mark, she said from her bed.
What?
Is there something the matter? Nope. Good night, she said. Good night, said Mark McCranville. 5, 10 dark minutes passed. Reminds me of a cartoon in The New Yorker. Man, pot-bellied, balding, woman, hair curls, cold cream. She says to him, you never say good night anymore. If you don't want to tell me, she says, well, how the heck can I tell you when I don't know myself? Oh, she says, shall I come over? I just assumed you wouldn't. I don't know what it is. If I come over, you'll sleep better, she said. Jean, look, it isn't that. I sold 2 galaxies and a T-bird today. You did? That ought to make me feel good, but I don't know what's the matter with me. I had a couple of drinks at Ernie's, but nothing. I knew you had something to drink. It didn't show, but I could smell it. Oh, I'm not hiding anything. Well, you heard about the galaxies and the T-bird. I know I did. I'd have told you in the morning. All right, good night, good night. Later, he could tell that Jean was asleep, breathing regularly. She made 2 musical notes in deep sleep. The first 2 notes of, yes, sir, that's my baby. The yes note as she exhaled, the sir as she drew breath, and yet he could tell she was dreaming. This is your member now. He got out of bed and went to the warm living room and turned on 1 bulb and a table lamp. He lit a cigarette, took the first drag, but let it go out. He was 30 years old, a good father, a good husband, so well thought of that Mrs. Preston would make sure he got credit for a sale. His sister had a good job, his mother was taken care of, and the sales blackboard of the garage, his name was always first or second, and 2 years had not been down to 3rd. Nevertheless, he went to the hall closet, got out his 20-gauge, and broke it, and inserted a shell. He returned to his chair and relit the cigarette that had gone out, and this time he smoked rapidly. The shotgun rested with the butt on the floor, the barrel lying against his thigh, and he held the barrel loosely with the fingers of his left hand as he smoked. The cigarette was now down to 1 inch in length, and he crushed it carefully. Her voice came softly. Mark, she said. He looked at the carpet. What? Don't. Please. I won't, he said. Not great literature, but why don't we see the clues? Why don't we take the time to listen? To look behind the masks. Often we're so busy with church work, my schedule, my appointments, my day. I served the only Lutheran church in Greene County for 1.5 years, and White Castle, a little house church for 1.5 years on the weekends when I was prop here in the 60s. One Thursday, one of the congregation called me up, or the visitor did, visitator, and he said, so-and-so hung himself in the barn, funeral Saturday. The guy was right in the front row last Sunday, I thought. I rushed to see the sermon I preached last Sunday. Was there gospel in it? Yes, thank God there was. You know, why didn't we see the clues? Why didn't we take the time? To those around us who need our help, who are just groping, or are we sometimes the gropers? Are you a groper? Are you a griper? Are you a pupil of Pyrrho, P-Y-R-R-H-O, a founder of a school of skeptics in ancient Greece? Have you in your view of the ministry at times drifted towards what might be called the tragic vision? John Killinger has written some books in homiletics, also a book called The Fragile Presence, Transcendence in Modern Literature. And he recounts this letter of an atheist friend of his that wrote to him and said, I have what is called the tragic vision of man's place in the universe. We are here as on a darkling plain, destined to death when we just come to know the pleasures of life. Life, I need not tell you, is filled with injustices. Were you or I in charge of existence, we would make things much more equitable. One of the most penetrating of the quatrains of the Rubaiyat is this one addressed to God. O thou whom man of baser earth didst make, and even with paradise devised the snake, for all the sin wherewith the face of man is blackened, man's forgiveness give and take. Those last 2 words should be underlined. What about the homosexual, the black murderer, the dope-crazed thief, the dependent, thousands of others? They are at least in part the victims of circumstances, yet they're judged by conventional standards bent on condemnation. If there is a God, he is the one who takes into account all the factors in the situation, the one who is the very antithesis to evangelical morality. If he isn't this, he isn't worth having. Or as Kurt Vonnegut said in a recent interview, if there is a God, I don't think he's very nice. Or in Joseph Heller's Catch-22, hospital bedbound Yosarian is sparring with Lieutenant Shishkov's wife. And he says, and don't tell me God works in mysterious ways. There's nothing so mysterious about it. He's not working at all. He's playing. Or else he's forgotten all about us. The kind of a God you people talk about. A country bumpkin, a clumsy, bungling, brainless, conceited, uncouth hayseed. when you consider the opportunity and the power he had to really do a job, and then look at the stupid, ugly little mess he made of it instead, his sheer incompetence is almost staggering. Stop it! Stop it! Lieutenant Shrieskop's wife screams and she begins to beat him around the head with her fist. Stop it! Yossarian ducks behind his arm for protection and then grabs her by the wrists and pushes her down on the bed. He says, what the heck are you getting so upset about? I thought you didn't believe in God. I don't, she sobbed, bursting violently into tears. But the God I don't believe in is a good God, a just God, a merciful God. He's not the mean and stupid God you make him out to be. Is there any of the purest in your heart of hearts? What doubts do you have? How many Lutheran pastors out there are skeptics at heart? I don't want to be judgmental, but do we ever entertain these doubts? I'm thinking more broadly now of pastors I've worked with the last 43 years or so. Outside of the Missouri Synod, too. And some answer these questions in a way that you might not expect. The longer you're in the ministry, or prepare for the ministry, do you really believe in a weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth kind of hell? Question. Is the sacrament of Holy Communion really a point in time when one receives the forgiveness of sins, or is it mostly celebration? Whatever that means. Or as one Lutheran pastor on the West Coast said, frankly, I don't believe what I used to about Holy Communion. It's mostly an art form for me. Question. As some Lutherans move towards more ecumenism, but is the evil not among us? Do we really believe that only Christians are validly called the children of God, or are pious Jews also in the kingdom? Question. Are we so mature theologically that we have actually sometimes embraced an avant-garde, sophisticated neo-universalism? We wouldn't like to have it called that. But extending such a position to its logical conclusion, need Christ really have died and risen again? Is Christ really the way or one of the ways? And brethren, this is not so much an aside or a footnote. I still believe beyond synergism, when 5,000 Lutherans in Strumann study, of those 5,000, 40% still believe in work righteousness, moralism, which plagues our teaching and preaching, and preconditionalism, making faith a work, and the mixing of law and gospel, I still believe that universalism is the greatest threat ahead of us. To take away that cardinal truth of Scripture and your and my faith, that Jesus Christ is the only way of salvation. We've got to be prepared for it, and its subtle ways of attacking us in the church. But my question to our heart of hearts and to pastors out in the field who are often getting away from the moorings of the inerrant Scripture. Are preachers sometimes posing as proclaimers of the pure word, but inside, often to a great extent, they're really pupils of Pyrrho, skeptical, not really sure what they believe anymore. I could go into John Richard Newhouse before he went to Rome, his description of apostasy in the Lutheran Forum, August 88. It's a beauty. I see Lutheran churches in the West Coast, not Missouri, where the criterion of truth is the worshiping assembly. And forgiveness means you do your thing, baby, I'll do mine. Are you a groper? Are you a griper? Are you a grouper? You know, it's a pretty good life out there. After you're in the ministry for a while, it can be materially quite rewarding. And we can often become, with our people, people who are coddled in complacency, perpetuated by piety pills and psychiatry. We can follow the pattern, just follow the crowd with a capital P. We can become the bland being led by the bland. We can just become submerged in the mass. It's like two cows standing in a cow pasture. Milk truck goes by, and on the side of the truck is a sign, fresh milk, grade A, standardized, pasteurized, vitamins added. And the one cow turns to the other and says, it makes you feel kind of inadequate, doesn't it? It's so easy to just become part of the mass. As one person put it, standardized, homogenized, then medically tested, advertised as atomized and maybe pre-digested, refrigerated, packaged, dated, delivered to the diner, you can't deny the part played by the cow seems rather minor. I'm not saying that the good things of this life, tatu kosmu, are evil in and of themselves. Lunch is coming, hang on, but I would like to affirm this morning such things as big juicy steaks and lobster, beautiful homes, swimming pools, exciting jewelry, new clothes in fashion, delicate perfume, new golf clubs, colorful jogging suit, good glass of beer, some red, touch of the red from Napa, fine wine. All these things are gifts of God, and they should be affirmed. But the only danger is let's not fall in love with them, get hooked on them. The trouble is, it's very easy to, with our people, as time goes by, and you get that new car and a fine home, to become part of that world. And these are the people who are not looking for the city of God coming down from the skies, but rather a vast conjuring trick coming up from the mines and the factories, a paradise of layer cake houses and clothing made of soybeans and skyscrapers made of glass and automobiles shaped like eggs. We don't need any day of the Lord. General Electric and General Motors will take care of all of our needs. Thank you. That's sort of summed up in the little poem, The Ecstasy of Mr. Price by Morris Bishop. Mr. Price has assumed the fetal position, huddled, snuggled on the driver's seat. He touches his key to the ignition to feel the great, loving motor beat. In the upholstered womb, he has found security. He's fled from the world's windy woes away. Oh, cradling wash of bliss and lost purity, almighty, all-motor mother, oh, Chevrolet. You don't need people anymore if you have machines, but these are the people who are living in a mental imaginary house of security. It's a neatly structured life, and it can be that way in the ministry, too. Here is the family room, anything for the kids. Here is the living room for status and entertainment. Here is the bedroom for sleep. Here is the room of the job, the ministry. The corporation has this man's soul. It's a neatly structured life, this mental imaginary house of security, but it's undergirded by only two matchstick props, status and money. And one of the two props taken away, the entire structure crumbles and falls. But while people are just going through the routines, it can be a pretty good life. And we need to challenge this life of the grouper and not become into it ourselves. We need to challenge people in the pews who are just going through the motions, the routines of worship, for example. One of my favorite stories is that of a man back here in the Midwest. It's about October. It's a stormy, rainy, thundery night. And the guy is going out in the country to a party. He's going to a masquerade ball dressed in, of all things, a devil's costume. Well, this guy's driving along a country road. His car goes off the road in the ditch. He can't get it started. And so he gets out of the car, makes his way across a cornfield, and he comes to a small country church. Well, the people are in this little country church having their evening prayer meeting, singing hymns and praying. And just as this guy, dressed in the devil's costume, mind you, gets to the door of the church and opens it, there's a bolt of lightning, a clap of thunder. All the people turn around, see the devil standing there. They go out of the doors and windows as quick as they can, except for one little lady standing in the center aisle, scared stiff. She says, "Mr. Devil, I don't know what you want here, but I got only one thing to say. I've been a member of this church for 40 years, but I've really been on your side all the time." And so it's very easy just to be a grouper, just going through the motions. I'm going to have to move along here. Are you, however, finally a gripper? Have you gripped Christ's hand in faith? Scratch that. That's bad theology. We don't grip his hand. He has gripped us. You have not chosen me, but I have chosen you out of this world. He called us in holy baptism. It was a totally unilateral act. As I know some of you in Curry's Head are studying Dr. Repp's writings, Confirmation of the Lutheran Church, we really need to, again and again, as we have been, put baptism back into its proper place in the church and deflate confirmation, which Luther called monkey business, a fraud, and a humbug, as it was falsely viewed in his day. Are you gripped by Christ, and therefore are you one who can become in your ministry? And your ministry, it's not something you're preparing for. You're into each other right now here today, less fearful and finally more faithful. Are you bound to become less fearful? Gus Schultz, who now serves the chapel that I served on College Avenue, a block from the People's Park in Berkeley, once was in a horrendous auto accident. He learned later his car was totaled. He woke up in a hospital bed, and he felt himself, got out of bed very carefully, walked over to the windowsill, picked up the chart. There was his name, Gus Schultz, condition critical. Condition critical, it means he could die at any minute. Put the chart down, walked very slowly, very carefully back to his bed, lay down and developed what he called his theology of failure. Totally give oneself up to God, to totally say, "Lord, you take over, do that in me which I cannot do." The great Kierkegaardian leap. Not a leap into the darkness, but leap in the arms of a loving God. A God who tells us, 1 Corinthians 10:13, there hath no testing taken you but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not permit you to be tested beyond your strength, but will, with the testing, provide the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. There's law and gospel there. You can't blame God. But God is always there. He never tests you beyond your strength. As a black woman said on the old Starsky and Hutch programs, the Lord don't give you more than you can handle. So are you less fearful? Commit your way unto the Lord, and he shall give you the desires of thine heart. As Kimmerer used to say, whose office was right up there, that doesn't mean the Lord will give you what your little heart desires, but he'll put the right desires into your heart, and you shall mount up like eagles. For perfect love casts out fear. And are you finally one who will be more faithful? It is required in stewards not that one is found always effective or successful, but faithful. He who lives with faith lives with victory. I think our basic problem often is right here. The problem is not that God doesn't know what's going on in our lives or in the church. It's like some of these informative prayers that we get in church occasionally. Oh, Lord, you know, we've got problems in synod. We've got a problem in our seminary. We've got problems in the district. We've got problems in this. And his friend said, what's the matter? Don't you think the Lord reads the Lutheran Witness? God knows what's going on. He knows. He cares. Our problem, brethren, is that we don't really believe the mighty promises of God. We don't really believe the mighty promises. We've got 8,910 of them in the Bible. As thy days, so shall thy strength be. Dr. Walter A. Meyer Sr.'s favorite passage on his deathbed. Underneath are the everlasting arms. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I will help thee, I will strengthen thee. Yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness. But we often doubt that, and we are not faithful. You may know the old story. There are several versions of it. A guy, dark, late at night, he's wandering around, falls off a cliff, sliding down the embankment, and he finally grabs hold of a tree. He doesn't know it, but his feet are just a couple of feet off the canyon floor. And he calls out where he came from, and he said, is there anybody up there who can help me? And a rather awesome voice says, let go. You'll be all right. There's a pause, and then the guy says, is there anybody else up there? Our problem often is that we doubt a loving God who says, I know the thoughts I peace have towards you, thoughts of peace and not of evil. A friend of mine went home for lunch on the West Coast, one of our pastors, teachers, and met his little son at the door. He had two kids under the age of five, and the son said, Daddy, a man came, and he talked to Mommy, and then they went upstairs, and the man left, and now Mommy is sleeping. And Don Waldo went upstairs and found his wife, Sharon, raped and strangled. He went on TV and asked the public to forgive the man who had done this. I think it was a mental patient. They couldn't really pin it down. Could you, a person being faithful, ask that? Could you then write, as they did in the bulletin for the Eucharistic funeral service, which was a service of Easter joy, the black border around this paper is not only for the memory of Sharon or for the grief of her loved ones, but for a sick humanity. All of us have felt in these days something of the terrible misery of what it means to be human. For a short time, the mask was stripped away, and we caught a glimpse of the hell in human hearts, the hell of lovelessness, of hatred, of callousness to other people, of our ready willingness to consume each other. But it is precisely at this point, at graveside, that Christianity, if it is to have any meaning at all, must begin to make sense. For it was to the very depths of this tragic human existence that God came personally in Jesus Christ, and it was here that he redeemed us and our existence. The mercy is this, that we who have faced our humanity in all its horror are now enabled through Christ's death and resurrection to realize our humanity in all its glory, the glory of love. Final story. Presume it's summer here in St. Louis, and you're walking through the neighborhood and you see a station wagon in the driveway. A lot of baggage on the top. Three little kids, all under the age of 5, in this station wagon. Father's closing the garage door, the mother's closing the front door. And you walk up to these kids and you say, "Where are you going?" They don't know. "Where are you going to have dinner tonight?" They don't know. "Well, what highway are you going to take?" They don't know. "Where are you going to sleep?" They don't know. "With whom are you going?" you ask. And their eyes lighten up and they say, "With Mommy and Daddy, of course." They didn't have all the answers to your questions, but they knew with whom they were going, and that was enough for them. And you, are you a groper, a griper, a grouper, or a gripper, having been gripped by Christ in your baptism? You may not have the answers to many of the questions that face you right now, especially those of you going in vicarage and seniors awaiting calls. The life ahead looks uncertain. But you do know with whom you are going. He is by your side every step of the way. Do you really need anything more?